Hello and welcome to the No Ceilings NBA Draft Show. Today is a deep dives episode. I'm your co-host, Nick A.R. Johnson, editor-in-chief and staff writer for No Ceilings NBA. And I'm here as always with my co-host, Paige Otto. Paige, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing great, Nick. It's negative degrees outside, but I'm in here in my apartment staying warm, talking hoops with you. So no better place to be.
Well, you're in negative degree weather, and I'm playing under the weather. I'm played a little hurt today, so, you know, if I sound even worse than I usually do, that's why. But, you know, tough it out. Gotta be a road warrior for this sort of thing.
There we go.
Shall we get started with your player for today?
Yeah, let's do it.
So, Paige, you decided to go with Duke Blue Devils defensive star Dame Sarr for this week's Deep Dives episode, so let's throw it to you. Why did you go with Dame Sarr for today?
Yeah, I think I wanted to switch it up a little bit in terms of the prospects that I typically talk about. I think through the past couple months that we've been, you know, doing the show this season, I kind of go for the, you know, 3-and-D type style wings or, you know, these microwave score prospects. And with Dame, you know, he's so defensive minded. And he is, you know, he's shown offensive flashes, right? And, you know, part of, he hasn't really come up to speed as much as I've hoped so far for Duke this past year. But I mean, he's only 19 years old, right? For those that don't know, he kind of came onto the scene a little bit more at the Nike Hoop Summit that you were also at, Nick. So I'm excited to hear your thoughts about, you know, seeing him in person. But that's when he really like caught my eye, right? Because before that, you know, he's playing for FC Barcelona. He kind of started playing for the B team. And then the last year before he went to Duke, you know, he played for the main team. And he made his Spanish ACB league debut for FC Barcelona's first team when he's only 16 years old. So, you know, he's been playing with grown men, right, for the past 3 years. And with, you know, playing overseas, it's so more fast paced and more tempo compared to college, right? And the best thing about Dame on the offensive side of the ball is he's great in transition, right? You know, he's a burst in transition, burst energy, you know, he ranks in the excellent category. And, you know, he's a great coast-to-coast driver, not that great of an off-ball mover, slasher, cutter, in my opinion. He's basically, I mean, he only played 12 minutes per game with FC Barcelona too, right? So he didn't really get a lot there just because of the stacked roster, and obviously he's such a young prospect as well, and he played in limited amount of minutes. Just to go over the numbers a little bit, let me see, so he averaged 5.8 points per game on 42.9, 59.3, and 55.6 shooting splits last year for FC Barcelona. So and if you look at what he's doing for Duke now, right, 5.9 points, 3.4 rebounds, just under assists per game on 38.4, 32.3, 52.6 shooting splits. And that's, you know, with him playing double more minutes, right? You know, he's about 20.4 minutes per game too. So I think he, and Duke doesn't play a lot in transition at all, right? So with most of Dame Sarr's, you know, offensive profile being him in transition because he can't really shoot, right? And I don't really trust him that much with the ball in his hands. And as an off-ball scorer, he doesn't move a lot, right? He kind of just goes into the corner and then he'll try to get up a three-point shot here and there. But, you know, he's wide open for a reason, right? And there's so many opportunities and possessions that I'm just like, cut to the ball, like move with the ball, go to the basket, because he's so... He has the length, he has the size of what you look for in an NBA modern, you know, Swiss Army knife, right? You know, he's 6'9", 190 pounds, you know, he has that length and size and speed to him. But he really struggles to use it when he's not, you know, going coast to coast in transition and in these half court sets. He doesn't really get himself involved either just because he's not the best off ball mover. And I think his process and ability is not quite there yet of what to do off ball. And his playmaking too, right? I mean, he only has 15 assists on the season, which, you know, if he doesn't have the shot or, you know, he's not getting to line as much either and struggles there, you know, you would hope to see a little bit more playmaking out of him. But I mean, he's usually just making the first read only and then kind of, you know, struggles to, you know, what do I do next? And last night's game, obviously it was the second biggest game of the night behind BYU and Arizona, but some of the, on a couple possessions, I mean, his body language really showed too. If, you know, if the first three doesn't happen, if he gets stuck, you know, in the paint and the defense is swarmed, you know, he made kind of a lazy pass, one-handed, left-handed pass out from getting caught in the corner when the shot clock was low. And he kind of was just like, okay, here you go. Like, I don't want it anymore. Like, it's your problem. And he kind of, you know, threw up his hands and was frustrated. And there's been a lot of those types of plays where, you know, he gets really frustrated when things don't go his way the first time around. And it's kind of like, play through it. You know what I mean? And there's so many, he has all the offensive tools. He just needs to, you know, show a little bit more, because, you know, if he's not shooting the best, you know, he's only shooting 32% from the 3-point line on, you know, less than 2 attempts per game. Right. So, yeah, so that's he's kind of all over the place for me, but I mean, well, we can break down his offense right now, and then obviously we can go into defense a little bit more in depth too after.
Yeah, so we definitely should talk about the defense in depth, because that is the best part of the Dame Sarr profile. You mentioned I did, in fact, have the privilege of seeing Dame Sarr live at Hoop Summit last year. And the thing that stands out more than anything else when you see him live is people who are as tall as he is are not supposed to be as fluid as he is with his movement. Like, yeah. he does not have choppy movements when he's, you know, getting in a defensive stance. He's someone who, even when the shots aren't going in, you know, you mentioned the attitude issues potentially, but I don't know. I mean, for me, seeing him live, it was very much just, you don't see that kind of fluidity in someone that size very often. And it's one of those things where he absolutely exercises that on the defensive end, doesn't always on the offensive end. And it's interesting in terms of the offensive profile, because there are a couple of reasons why I'm holding out hope. And there are a couple of things that I'm really concerned about. And they are the opposite of what I thought would be my thoughts on him heading into the year, which is, he's actually been decent as a jump shooter, and a lot of his misses have been when he's unguarded, which he shoots a much worse percentage unguarded than guarded, which to me represents small sample size more than anything else, right? Like, if you get a sample of more than, you know, 25, 30 three-pointers, you know, logically speaking, you would expect, hey, if I'm guarded, I'm less likely to hit than if I'm unguarded, right? So the fact that he's doing better on his guarded shots than his unguarded shots, to me, just says, hey, once the sample size gets a bit larger, then you'll start seeing more success there. He's shooting 50% at the rim, and that really worries me. And, you know, it's a small sample size of layups, because, you know, not most of the time, but, you know, he can get up and throw down dunks, right? So it's like, if he's throwing down, that's not too much of a problem. But, and again, I want to say small sample size one more time before I say the number I'm about to say. He's shooting 36.4% on layups this season. For someone as big and athletic and, you know, not just athletic, but coordinated and smooth as he is, that number makes no sense to me. And, you know, you brought up the 52.6% free throw shooting. That's an issue, certainly. But normally when I, you know, talk about my partial free throw truther stance, it's because oftentimes the sample is larger, and also there's more variance between good free throw shooters and bad free throw shooters, which gives you a bit better of an indication. But Dame Sarr has taken almost twice as many threes as he has free throws. So, you know, to me, that's like, okay, the poor free throw number is not a positive. I don't want to, you know, state it that way, but it's also like, there are reasons to buy into him as a shooter, and the fact that he's done better on guarded looks than unguarded looks is one of them. But if he can't get to the line and can't hit his free throws and shoots 50% at the rim and 36% on layups, that's a much bigger problem for me than anything to do with any of the shooting stuff.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Because when it's kind of like, oh, he doesn't finish at the rim well, right? You know, he's shooting 50% at the rim. You know, he's shooting just a little bit over 50% from the free throw line, but he's shooting more threes than getting to the free throw line. But it's also just, and then he's shooting better unguarded. So it's kind of like, what is the consistent piece to his offensive side? And it's kind of like, I'm not really sure, because there's so many questions in terms of, okay, I know what, you know, Dame Sarr is going to do when the ball's in his hands. I know he's going to at least get an easy bucket or easy look at the rim. But I can't even say that, because he's not as great as a cutter as, like, I thought he would be as of now with Duke, which is something I was planning on, you know, at least leaning on at this point of the season from last year, you know, with Barca, right? Just because he was so, I mean, you mentioned his fluidity and mobility. I mean, he moves like so great for his size. I mean, in his size and length, and he really knows how to use it, especially on the defensive side of the ball as well. I mean, he is just such a fluid mover, and he's just an NBA level athlete in every, you know, sense of the word. But it's kind of like, where is that on the offensive end? Because a lot of his looks too, and like when he's troubled with contact at the rim, you know, he will make like a good finish here and there, but then it's kind of like, okay, where is that, like, you know, five attempts per game or like a little bit more? Because it's kind of like, it's kind of not like a one and done type of, you know, going to the rim. But I mean, since Duke doesn't play that much in transition, right, it's kind of like, where is he getting these at rim opportunities that he did so much of, you know, with Barca? So I think, you know, him adjusting to playing more in the half court and, you know, learning more how to play off ball would really help him in terms of me seeing his upside on the offensive end, because right now I just kind of see him, you know, as a defensive minded you know, spear. So I'm excited to see how, you know, as we get through conference play, and obviously we'll talk about our other prospect that you chose, but yeah, there's a lot of questions I have with him, but it's a lot with him, Nick.
Yeah, you and I are suckers for prospects who can cut well, as we've talked about before. And it's something that's very easy to do to make yourself more valuable off ball, especially when you're not a shooter, and especially when you're the kind of athlete that Dame Sarr is. So that to me just seems weird more than anything else. Whereas, you know, the at rim stuff, it's like, if this, both the level of, you know, frequency in terms of him getting all the way to the rim, but also his finishing once he gets there, it just doesn't fit with the rest of the profile. And I was fully expecting, you know, heading into this year, okay, he's not going to shoot at all, but he's going to do enough of the little things offensively that, you know, you'll get to see him play defense, which is where he shines. So why don't we, unless you have something else to say on the offensive end, I don't mean to cut you off at all, but I do want to talk about the defense, because that's a lot more fun to talk about with Tommy.
Yeah, let's get to the fun part. Let's get to the defense.
So, yeah, your thoughts on Tommy Sarr's defense.
I mean, defensively, you know, the past three games, you know, he was on the top, you know, scorers, point guards, right? You know, he was on Ibuka Okoro at Stanford, you know, he was on Juke Harris, you know, at Wake Forest, and then he was on Ryan Conwell a little bit last night at with Louisville. So he's on the best players of the team, and every shot he makes is hard for them. It doesn't matter if, you know, you're bigger than him, shorter, faster than him, you know, he's going to stay in front of you and make every shot hard for you because of his length, his size, his mobility, his fluidity as well. And he's also great at, you know, his rotations and getting into his spots as well. I obviously, you know, with every prospect, you'll get caught looking, you know, here and there, and maybe not in the right position at times. But I mean, he's always in a defensive stance. You know, he has his hands up. He's great at, you know, going through screens and cutting screens as well. And also as a chaser as well. And I think him being such a versatile defender at, you know, 6'9", 190 pounds, I mean, you can stick him on, you know, the fastest guards of them at all. I think he's more, you know, 1 through 4, probably, Nick. I wouldn't really trust him on, you know, true centers and big man as of right now, just because of, you know, his archetype. But I think with his switchability, I think if he, you know, was switched on a big man, you know, here and there, I think he could hold his own, but I wouldn't want that to be like his main matchup at all times. I really, you know, like him so much as an off-ball defender, and especially on, you know, taking the matchups of, you know, these PG1s, if you will. So, I mean, that's the selling point with him right there. So I've been super impressed so far this season.
We've talked over the past few episodes about a number of guards who are essentially locked in as point of attack defenders because of their size, where it's like, you kind of have to put Christian Anderson on that guy, because if you put him on someone who's 6'7", he's not going to have a good time. The thing with Dame Sarr that makes it so hard for me to lower him on my board, despite the really very small amount that we're getting from him on the offensive end, is, as a, you know, 6'9 point of attack defender, that's a different proposition than when you're talking about someone who has to be locked there, Because then, you know, you said it already, right? It's like, whoever the best player is, Dame Sar is on them, right? Yeah. You know, if you're on a team with, you know, say, Luka at, you know, in theory, point guard, right? And then, you know, Gabe Vincent or whoever else the Lakers are throwing out there as, like, point guard defensively, but 100% not, you know, primary initiator offensively. It doesn't matter to Dame Sar. Whoever the best offensive player is, that's, you know, again, as you mentioned, barring a bulky center, that's the player you want on that guy, right? Whoever your offensive engine is, you stick Dame Sar on that guy, yeah, and you feel great about it. And it's one of those things where, again, it's very, very valuable to have a good point of attack defender, right? Part of the reason why I'm as high on Kingston Flemings and LeBaron Filon as I am is because those guys are going to be fantastic point of attack defenders at the NBA level. But you switch them on to a Brandon Miller, and it's not going to be pretty. Dame Sar can take basically all these guys. Mm-hmm. And that makes it so much easier to find a defensive fit for him, and also so much more frustrating to try and wrap your mind around the offensive profile, because, you know, if he were slightly better at any of the three levels of scoring, it would just be an easy proposition. Okay, he's going to stand in the dunk spot, and that's going to be fine, because we don't need him to be an offensive contributor. It's just any tiny little bit more that he does, either as a shooter or as a finisher, makes it even easier to justify getting him out there, because once any coach sees this guy defend, it's like, okay, I want this guy to play as many minutes as possible.
No, I 100% agree. I mean, you mentioned it. It's like, okay, Dame is going to guard the best player no matter what, and I'm going to feel awesome about it, and I don't really have to worry about him, you know, messing up. And then it's like, oh, on the offensive end, it's like a complete, you know, flip of the coin, right? Because it's the complete other end of the stick, just because of, you know, everything we already talked about. But yeah, I mean, a 6'9 point of attack of defender, as good as he is, I mean, it's such an easy selling point of his, you know, transability, you know, to the next level. And he's only 19 as well. So there's so much upside of that. And then, you know, if you look into, you know, hey, what if he, you know, shot 36% on 4, you know, 3-point attempts per game, and, you know, finished at least 60% at the rim, you know, he's a first round lock, right?
He's probably a lottery lock if he does that.
Yeah, lottery lock. Yeah. Maybe I'm playing a little bit too low, just because I'm like, it's not reality, but it's like a fun, you know, proposition. But yeah, exactly. So, and those are not like out of the mind, you know, ask for him either. I mean, honestly, I'd be happy with him even getting close to, you know, 57% from the rim at this rate, but, and getting to the line at least, you know, four times per game, right? Because, I think just understanding how he can, you know, take what he's so good at the defensive end and, you know, switching that to the offensive end, just, you know, in spots here and there. Sorry, the train's going by in the background, if you can hear it, but, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to like with him. I think everyone loves his defense, right? And there's not a lot of nitpicks you can do when talking about the defensive side of the ball with Dame Sar. It's just a matter of, okay, can he at least provide any more, you know, plus minutes on the offensive side of the ball to, you know, I mean, I know you stepped aside a little bit last night, Nick, for the Louisville-Duke game, but he didn't play much of the second half. Granted, you know, Duke was blowing out Louisville at this point. But I mean, he came in with, I think, like 8 minutes left. I mean, he was out for a decent amount of time, and he didn't impact or, you know, score, right? And even in those situations in a blowout, I mean, Cam Boozer was still, you know, taking it to Louisville. But with Dame, you know, in those situations, it's like, get some more shots up, you know, cut to the rim, move to the ball in those situations. Like, this is your opportunity. But yeah, I have no ill feeling about his defensive side. It's just more, I need to see more for him on the offensive side of the ball.
Where are you at with him in terms of three levels? And we can discard the mid-range stuff, because he has taken a combination of one runner, hook, and off the dribble jumper this year. And it was an off the dribble three that he hit. So congrats to him. He has the highest possible points per shot on his off the dribble jumpers, because he took one from 3-point range and he made it. So, you know, 150% effective field goal percentage isn't bad, but yeah, I mean, I sort of already talked about this, but I'm curious where you're at. But I think that him recovering perception wise as a shooter is going to be a lot easier than the at rim stuff, because I think it's a lot more likely that he starts hitting his unguarded catch and shoots than that he makes a radical adjustment in terms of how often he's getting to the rim and how well he's doing when he gets there.
Yeah, I mean, I see him making that adjustment to his three-point shooting way more than I see him adjusting as a slasher and cutter, just because that's way more harder to do. And just like the timeliness of, you know, when to cut, when not to cut, when to go and relocate, or when to stay, right? I think that takes a lot more processing ability, and I don't think he's there quite there yet as an off-ball mover and shooter. But in terms of, you know, upping his unguarded threes, like you mentioned, I think that's a little bit more of a, you know, safer ask in terms of, you know, projecting, you know, his levels when it comes to him as a scorer.
All right. Shall we move on to player number two?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today, and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, so you mentioned briefly the Duke Louisville game that Louisville, sorry. I know how it said, people from Louisville. I just slipped up that time, I promise. Anyway, Louisville, the Louisville Duke game. And I picked someone on the other side of that game in Ryan Conwell, who profile wise seems like much more of a Paige prospect than a Nick prospect. So, Paige, what are your thoughts on Ryan Conwell?
Yeah, I mean, Ryan Conwell's a certified bucket getter. I mean, this dude is one of the best secondary options just because he's a, you know, more of a combo guard in the country. I mean, him pairing with, you know, Mikal Brown Jr., they have one of the best backcourts in the country when Mikal's healthy, right? Obviously, last game wasn't his best showing, right? But you know, he's 6'4", 210, has, you know, real strength and he's built, right, for an undersized point guard, can get a bucket at all three levels. Yes, his, you know, at-rim finishing is a little bit low on that side. You know, it's less than 60%. I believe, I know the numbers right in front of me. But, I mean, it's his fourth school in 4 years, too, Nick. You know, he started at South Florida, then Indiana State, then Xavier, then Louisville, right? So this is his first year, you know, in the ACC in a, you know, Power Four conference too. And, you know, he showed up big time. I mean, his production, you know, he's shooting, he's averaging, you know, 10, over 10 3-point attempts per game. And just diving into the numbers a little bit more, 19.4 points per game, 5 rebounds, 2.5 assists on 40.6, 37.3 and 82.6 shooting splits. And yeah, he can get a bucket anywhere, and he's so crafty and so patient. And I think one of the most underrated, you know, skills of his game too, Nick, is that I think he's a great screener, guard to guard screener. Just because he has such a awesome, strong base for his size, and he plays a lot bigger than, you know, 6'4". And, you know, obviously he's more than Dame Sarr too, right? So, yeah, I mean, he has that to go off of, and, you know, he's great at, you know, even if he switched on, you know, big man on the post off of missed shot or anything, you know, the effort is there. You know, he tries to at least bar the big man down low. I really like the give and go actions with him and Mikal Brown as well. And I think him being a good screen on the offensive end, that opens up so much more for him too, because he's such an excellent cutter and slasher. And he just knows how to read the game. I mean, his processing ability, his playmaking ability, the dude's a winner. And I'm glad to see that, you know, he's getting a lot more recognition this year as well. I think on our latest mock draft, he was a high second round pick. I forget where he went to, but I mean, he's a winning impact player. And if it wasn't for him last night against Duke, I mean, they probably would have been blown up by 50 or more. I mean, and yes, it was a blowout, but it seems like, you know, Ryan Conwell, he always made that shot to, you know, cut the momentum. You know, he's a kind of a momentum killer prospect. He's just in every possession, in every play. And yeah, I mean, he's a lot of fun to watch.
So there are two things that I'm really glad that you mentioned. The first of which is four schools in 4 years, essentially climbing in level of competition every single time. and essentially producing more at every single spot. Like his his sophomore and junior years stat wise are virtually identical, other than him not rebounding as much at Xavier, which I think is more of a Xavier versus Indiana State big man thing than it is a Ryan Conwell thing. But, you know, the fact that he's been at four schools in 4 years and is playing tougher competition essentially every year and is getting better essentially every year is really, really difficult to pull off and says a lot about him. The other thing that you brought up that I think is a fascinating point of discussion is his screening. There was one play from last night's game that I'm going to remember for a very long time, which was Mikael Brown Jr. had the ball and he was getting doubled. And Ryan Conwell, it was like an offensive tackle move. He like basically takes out both of the guys that were doubling Mikael. Like he just sort of gets up in their grill and is like, well, we can't abandon this guy because he's the best shooter on the team. And it's like, that was maybe the most open lane to the basket that Mikael Brown Jr. got all night last night. And, you know, if I remember the way that play ended, I think it was Mikael missed a layup, Duke got the rebound, and that was the end of the possession. But the part that I remembered was, what is this 6'4 dude doing, like, offensive tackle style screening these two guys out of the play? It was wild. And a very good sign of just how, yeah, okay, he's 6'4, but he takes up a lot more space than your average 6'4 guy. And I mean that in only the best possible way.
Yeah. I mean, when I was watching the film, I was like, I mean, he is like everywhere. I mean, even when the ball's not in his hands, because, you know, I mentioned he's more of a combo guard, right? And then when Mikael Brown Jr. was hurt, he kind of had to take a lot more, you know, on the defensive end of the ball at times as a point of attack defender. But like as an off ball defender, I like him a lot better. We'll get into that later. But I mean, you don't see a lot of, you know, 6'4 guards, you know, wanting to take the tougher screens and matchups. And, you know, even on flares too, I mean, he's setting flare screens, you know, left and right to get, you know, his teammates open. And you just don't see that. And that just, you know, I think that it says a lot about him. I mean, four different schools in 4 years, you know, he's always the player that's kind of picking up the pieces, right? And it's kind of the stableness of the team too. But I've really enjoyed watching him at Louisville. I think, you know, him having, I think I saw like a super interesting, his freshman year at South Florida, his box for minus was actually -1.5, and now it's +10. And that just shows, I mean, obviously his college career, players grow, right? They grow up, they develop and everything. But I mean, just his level of production and impact at such a high rate too. I mean, his usage rate is just a little less than 30% too. And he's doing at such a high level. And his 3-point attempts per 100, I mean, he's getting off close to 19 3-point attempts per 100 possessions. I mean, he's just letting them fly left and right. Doesn't matter, you know, if you're taller than him, if you're faster than him, he's going to find a way to get a shot off. And I love his, you know, his movement shooting too, coming off of DHO's quick zoom actions. He'll take one or two dribbles and just, you know, light it up too. And obviously I love lefty shooters as well. So, I mean, his shot is, really pretty to watch as well. So
I'm really glad you brought up movement shooting, something that we have certainly talked about on here, but I think even still bears more discussion. Is shooting is a much broader term than I think it should be used as, in the sense of, there are a whole lot of different kinds of shooters. And the thing with Ryan Conwell is he's all of those kinds of shooters, right? I mean, you know, just a few numbers here for fun. He's in the 95th percentile as a spot-up shooter, right? Pretty good. Hard to get much better than 95th percentile. But he's also in the 80th percentile off screens, 93rd percentile on cuts, 69th percentile on handoffs, right? It's not just, oh, stand him in the corner and swing the ball his way and he's going to knock down those shots once he gets there, right? And I'm curious about it because he doesn't quite leap off the screen as like this crazy movement shooter in terms of, like, you know, you watch Steph Curry for like 3 minutes and it's like he's moving more than anybody else on the court. And Ryan Conwell is not quite at that level, but just in terms of the versatility of shooting, I mean, you know, he'll pull up from 25 feet, no problem. Like, you know, you run him around double drag screen, it's like, yeah, you know, grab the ball, shoot in rhythm, you know, grab, rise, fire, all very smooth. Again, it's not just, oh, you know, if you need to kick out to a shooter, he'll be there. He's the kind of shooter, and again, I think he could be even better at this, but he's the kind of shooter that creates openings, right? Rather than, oh, you feed in the ball, he's open, he'll make the shot. Like, he creates open looks, and a lot of that he does off ball, which you know, again, for a combo guard like him, he'll have the ball in his hands sometimes, but being able to do that kind of work off ball too is exceptionally important.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned him coming off, you know, these double drags, 77 actions, because, you know, you mentioned Steph. It's kind of like he gets set right away and just fires. Ryan Conwell kind of does like a little gather dribble a little bit and pushes it out for him. So when he's pushing out the ball, he's already in position rather than him, you know, just stepping with his right foot since he's a lefty and getting, you know, set. So he kind of creates that even more separation as he's already moving, which is super hard to do. But, you know, him showing that off movement is such a positive sign too when you're, you know, looking at his scoring arsenal as a whole, because we know he's the great shooter, right? Because he is, you know, he struggles at the rim, which surprises me just because of his frame and size and how he is so aware of, you know, his body control and his craftiness and shiftiness at the rim. But length does, you know, kind of bother him at times at the rim just because, you know, he is undersized guard. And, you know, that tends to happen when you're putting him against, you know, 6'10 and above or, you know, anything like that. But I'm curious of your thoughts, Nick, of, you know, what he struggles with at the rim wise.
Yeah. So at the rim stuff is interesting because this year he's shooting 53% at the rim, which is really not great. But throughout his college career, like his last two, and I don't have the South Florida numbers, but his last two seasons, he's been pretty close to average, you know, like 55, 56% at the rim. So I think that those numbers will look slightly better by the end of the year. He's not great at finishing around the rim. Like, I don't want to overstate the case, but he's also pretty far below what he normally does at the rim. Now, that being said, I do have one big concern, which is for as well built as he is, he's not a vertical athlete at all. Like, he had one dunk last year. He had one dunk the year before. He has zero dunks on the year this year. And so that's the kind of thing where if you're as bulky as he is, the problem is going to be length, right? It's not like he's not getting pushed off his spot by, you know, Joel Embiid or, you know, name your big lumbering big man, right? That's not the issue as much as it is the length. And so that's a concern for me where, you know, when we talk about someone like, say, when we talked about Christian Anderson, it's like, okay, but he's skinny enough that there's a projection of he's going to put on more weight and therefore be able to bounce off bodies more effectively, right? Conwell already has that kind of frame, which leads me to think, oh, the length is a lot more of a problem than the size. And that's a concern. And it's the lack of dunks combined with the fact that he's not all that great in transition as a finisher. Like as a trail shooter, he's fantastic because basically anything you could want a shooter to do, he does. Mm-hmm. Like he shoots well off the dribble. He shoots well, you know, catch all of the above, right? But it's the combination of the lack of dunks and the, you know, below average finishing outside of that, because again, those problems are going to be problems that he faces at the NBA level too. So I'm more worried about the athleticism deficit than I am about the raw finishing. I expect to look closer to his previous year numbers when the year ends, but it's not out of the question for him to be in this kind of range as a finisher at the NBA level, which, again, is a pretty far cry above Dame Sarr, which I think says a lot more about Dame Sarr than it says about Ryan Conwell. But it's the kind of thing where if I had to stamp a concern about one of the three levels of scoring, it would be the at-rim stuff, even though I think he's going to end the year in a slightly better place than where he's at right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think when we're talking about the at-rim stuff, I think a positive sign for him is that, you know, he is such a great downhill driver. And I think with his, you know, build and size is that he can take contact. It's more of like he'll do like a baby bump here and there and kind of just fade away for like a little paint jumper, right? But it's not a lot of, you know, a lot of crafty finishes. Yes, he can do reverse layups. You know, he can kind of do an up and under, those types of, you know, counters for that length and size and rim protection, right? But it's kind of, I would like to see him get at the line more. I mean, yes, this is the best year he's had at the line of, you know, getting there at least. You know, he's getting there at least 4.5 times per game. And compared to his career, let's see, his freshman year, only 1.2 attempts, 3.4, and then 3.9. And he's, you know, career 83.5% free throw shooter. So I think if he got to the rim more, right, or at least drew a lot more fouls and was able to convert, I think his rim finishing would go up, and then obviously his free throw attempts too, because there's no reason with, you know, his ability to kind of slither his way into defenses and to the rim and to shoot that he shouldn't at least get to the line at least, you know, six or seven, I'm not doing the meme, I'm just six or seven, you know, attempts per game at least, because I mean, given this is his highest attempts there through his career, I think that's an easy ask for him to do. And I think I'd be a lot more open-minded when it comes to, you know, seeing him at the NBA level. It's like, okay, he's not the best vertical athlete at all. I mean, he can't dunk the ball, right? But at least he's, you know, finishing on efficient, a consistent clip at the rim, and he's getting to the line. So I know he's, you know, trying to at least get there one point or the other.
Yeah, I mean, we brought this up with Ibuka Okori, right, where his at-rim finishing numbers were worse than both Conwell and Dame's are, but when you get to the line 9 times a game and you hit 80%+ of your free throws, you know, you're still – you're a positive finisher in the sense of for your team overall, right? Like maybe the number of, oh, okay, he's only hitting 50% at the rim, 53% at the rim, 50, whatever it is, right? If you're getting to the line that often, you're still playing efficient basketball because the most efficient shots in the game are free throws unless you're like a Shaq or a Dwight Howard, right? I'm curious where you're at with Conwell's passing, because you brought up the combo guard thing, and that's really interesting for me because I've basically purely thought about him as a shooting guard. Of like, I don't think, you know, I'm not saying he's a bad passer. He's fine. But like, I think of him much more as an undersized two guard than as a combo guard, because as much as I think the passing is fine, I just don't think it clears the point guard bar for me. So I'm curious where you're at with his playmaking for others.
Yeah, I think I'm taking in consideration just because he is undersized, right, in that sense of when I'm saying he's a combo guard. But I also think his processing ability is leaps and leaps ahead of, I think I feel way more confident in that and his playmaking at the NBA level than, you know, solely saying he's a shooting guard, just because he makes, you know, winning play after winning play time and time again. And he's always there in bad situations and gets his team out of it. And his playmaking, I mean, he's great at those head-to-head passes, great out of the short roll. He can go, you know, right hand or left hand, with left, obviously, you know, being his dominant hand. But I mean, even with in pick and pop scenarios, I mean, we saw it last year with, you know, Fremantle too, at Xavier too. And then he had Dalen Slane in the open court. A lot of these fun, you know, players that we've, you know, already talked about here on Deep Dives that he had to play off of last year. And I think his playmaking ability, he can make, you know, the first read, the second read, the third read. I mean, he's always thinking and he always has his head up and is ready to make plays for his teammates. So I think I'm a little bit more confident in his playmaking ability. And I think with Mikal Brown Jr. back, obviously still, you know, battling with injury, but I think we're going to see more playmaking from Ryan Conwell, just because he'll have to step up in that area too. And with the scoring, I mean, he has a lot on his plate too. But I think I'm a lot more confident just because of what I've seen on tape, that his processing ability, I just really trust it. Really.
I'm really glad you brought up the ambidexterity thing, because that's something that gets talked about with lefty guards a lot of, oh, just force him away from that left hand, where it's like, you know, these guys get through their entire high school careers with people who, you know, are trying to shade them the wrong way because they don't know what hand they are, right? And that's the kind of thing that you would hope that higher level players get adjusted to more quickly. But the flip side of that is when you get a lefty guard who is so good with both hands, then that's even more of a mess, because then teams, you know, actually do play them the right way and it still doesn't matter because they can finish with the other hand.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think with him too, is that I mean, it takes a special kind of player, Nick, to just have four different schools in 4 years and to adjust with new players. You know, NIL kind of just blew up, right, over the past 4 years, too. Different teammates coming and going. He's also, you know, finding new homes as well and trying to get adjusted. And he's been consistent through it all and has, you know, played off of it every year and gotten better and better and better. And I think with this year kind of being the most he's ever had, you know, usage wise, I mean, a 30% usage rate for him is pretty insane with the production he's had. And he, with him being, you know, he's 21, I believe he'll be 22 in June. But I mean, he's kind of on the older side, not really, right? But I mean, I think he has a lot to go off of. And I think he's one of the most reliable players in this draft class too, Nick, is in terms of, you know, his shooting ability, defensive wise, the winning plays he makes, his processing ability. And I think his rim finishing numbers and then his, you know, free throw rate will just continue to hopefully increase as, you know, the season goes on.
For reference, he is in fact young for his class. He will not turn 22 until the week before the draft.
Yeah. Okay.
That's so right. Yeah. You know, in terms of if you're comparing him to a teenager, yes, he's not a teenager, but he's on the younger side for finishing his, like, he's a few months older than my brother and he's finishing his senior year and my brother's finishing his junior year. So, you know, just for reference, shout out to you, my brother. Anyway, what do you think about Conwell's defense? I'm very curious with where you're at on that side of the ball for him.
Yeah, I think I like him a lot better as a 2-3 defender, a lot better, because with him, you know, I mentioned I'm so keen on his processing ability is because he is always in rotation. He's great. He's a great stunter too. He's always trying to say if his teammate, you know, kind of got caught ball watching, he's there to kind of step in and take that matchup and kind of not have, you know, someone open or have like an open shot. He's always involved in every play. As a point of attack defender, I don't trust him as much as a 2-3 defender, but you know, if he switched on, you know, the one, right, I don't think he's an awful liability at any sense of the word. I just like him so much more off the ball just because that's what he's used to. Right. And he is such a reliable threat. I mean, how he disrupts passing lanes. I mentioned stunting. I mean, even when, you know, he's not really going to close that on you, he'll kind of go like this to you. Right. And it kind of has the defender. Oh, should I attack the closeout? Should I drive to the rim? Should I kick it out to my teammates? He's always making these defenders guessing. And that says a lot about, you know, him being a 6'4 guard too.
Yeah, you mentioned the processing speed, and that's the kind of thing where I'm totally with you. I like the off-ball stuff a lot more than the on-ball stuff. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier of, I think basically any player who can't jump out of the gym automatically gets assigned the label bad athlete.
Yeah.
And with Conwell, I just think that he's someone who has very distinct physical advantages and very distinct physical disadvantages. And I think those play much better with the off-ball stuff than the on-ball stuff, especially given the processing, as you mentioned, right? Like, do I think that he can win a foot race against most of the point of attack guys? No. But do I think that he's stout enough that he can be a really solid wing defender who you want to have, you know, switching in a switching scheme? Because he's someone who, as you mentioned, is great at stunting, who can get in those passing lanes, who is much better at denying guys at getting to the rim by just getting in a low stance and blocking them off than he is winning a foot race. Which to me, again, you know, sort of symbolizes, okay, this is someone who you want more off ball. You want, you know, sort of on the wings rather than at the point of attack. And that's a good and a bad thing for Conwell, honestly, because given that he's 6'4", it would be easier for him if he was a better point of attack guy than an off ball guy. The flip side is, you know, I could scream at a donkey all day long and it's not going to be able to swim like a fish, right? Like, if you use him in a kind of way that he's good at handling defensively, I think he can be a defensive plus for a team. If you're throwing him out there and saying, hey, deal with Darius Garland, I don't think that's going to work. And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, if Ryan Conwell had Dame Sarr's height, this wouldn't be a conversation, right? He'd probably be a top 10 pick, you know, with his offensive game. If you make that guy 6'9", but also the other element of that is it makes how good Dame Sarr is as a point of attack defender stand out even more, because 6'9" guys aren't supposed to be able to move like that. But, you know, with the Conwell specific side of things, again, it's like, if you ask him to do too much defensively, I would be concerned. If you just want him to be a rotational cog in a defensive scheme, absolutely. And then, you know, the question from there becomes, okay, is he like a 10-minute a game 3-and-D shooting guard, or can he be something more? Is he good enough offensively to be something more? And I'm very curious, because I think he has that kind of offensive firepower within him, but it's all going to come down to, you know, the one reason I'm wary about Ryan Conwell is something that I've talked about with you before, of how I got a bit gun shy about this exact kind of player when Jacob Evans flamed out in the way that he did, because I was really high on Jacob Evans in his draft class. And it turned out that him being an okay athlete at the college level got to the NBA and was like, oh, this is a problem. Like, he's really not quick enough. And I'm worried about Ryan Conwell, like, buying into him too much for that kind of reason. But I also think that he's got that kind of sturdiness of frame that Jacob Evans never had. And also, like, he is enough of an outlier shooter, whereas Jacob Evans was a good shooter, but not the kind of, like, 10 attempts a game is nuts. And 10 attempts per game playing alongside Mikal Brown and Adrian Woolley, who I thought was going to be much more of a this year guy than he's turned out to be. Like, he's got a lot of great players around him, and he's still putting up absolutely wild shot numbers and hitting them too. So again, I'm a little more gun shy than I would be had I not had the Jacob Evans experience, but I think that his frame is solid enough that he'll hold up as a 2-3 guy, and then he just needs to score enough, and I'm quite confident that he can score enough.
Yeah, that's a good point, Nick. And I think with just going back to his defense a little bit, is that he's on these, you know, lengthy, skilled, you know, shooting guards that are, you know, 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", and upright, and he's making it hard every possession, at least just with his effort alone. But, I mean, with them, you know, being taller than him, you know, they're going to – it doesn't matter if he makes the shot as hard as he can, right? They're going to shoot it over him, which is, you know, a problem. But I'd rather him be off-ball, you know, defender than point of attack. But yeah, I mean, so I think too, since this draft class is so point guard heavy, is that it's going to take a lot for him to stand out even more than he already is. And to project him more than, you know, at the NBA level, just because this class is so loaded. And, you know, even like 5 years ago, I'd be like, okay, this guy is a first round lock, right? But I mean, point guards are just evolving, and combo guards, shooting guards, they're evolving with every possession, you know, year after year in so many different ways, that it's going to take a lot more than, you know, it's just being an insane shooter. Like, how are you at the rim? How are you at the free throw line? Can you table set for your teammates? Can you defend off ball, on the ball? And I think with him, you bring up a good point of just being weary about him, because I think I think he's a perfect prospect to kind of be like that on, just because of how his archetype pans out in the NBA. And it's kind of like a lottery on him, right? It's kind of like, I could see that, like, so much potential with him, but I could also see it not working out just because he's not that great of an athlete. But I think since he is such an absurd shooter and he has that volume there, and he also has that resiliency to him, I think, over the course of his year, I think I have a little bit more optimism just on his archetype than I probably normally would have in years past.
And, you know, it feels almost hypocritical to talk about him this way after I talked about Alex Caravan last week, right? Because Alex Caravan is a much worse athlete than Ryan Conwell. Yeah. But again, he's 4 or 5 inches taller, right? And just purely in terms of where can you hide this guy defensively, it's so much easier to hide a bigger dude. And so, again, it's one of those things where, and I'm very curious for your thoughts on this, but I feel like the last, you know, 2-3 years in particular, the line between point guard and shooting guard has gotten a lot sharper than it used to, where, you know, combo guards used to be talked about all the time, and a combo guard could, you know, it's funny because they were basically identical in terms of the way they played, but anyone from Lou Williams size to Jamal Crawford size could be considered a combo guard, right? And now I think it's a lot more about, you know, there are 6'9 guys who are point guards because that's what they do. They have the ball in their hands, right? Versus, okay, if you know, this is something I thought about quite a lot for Darren Peterson. I really hope that he could have been more of a point guard heading into the year. And where I'm at with it now is he's so special that it's totally fine. But like, if he were any other player, I would have that conversation in my mind of, it just feels like there are a lot fewer spots for vague, ambiguous guard than there used to be. And almost all of those slots are filled up by, if you're good enough to pass, then you're a point guard. And, you know, I don't want to be too biased by how much Sacramento Kings basketball I've watched, but it's like, other than Russell Westbrook, that team is basically all shooting guards. And that does not lead to the most effective offense, which the Kings have now climbed out of the basement, but they were the 30th ranked offense for quite a while, a few weeks ago. And, you know, that's because, again, they had a lot of guys who wanted to shoot and not a lot of guys who wanted to pass. And I'm curious where you're at with that in general. With Conwell specifically, I'm less concerned than I might be just because of the processing speed stuff that you mentioned. It's not that he doesn't see the passes. It's just that, hey, when you're playing with Mikal Brown, you're not always going to have the ball in your hands.
Yeah, I think as we, you know, as the NBA develops and, you know, years keep growing and stuff, is that we're moving to positionless basketball, right? And there's such more fewer spots. And you have these, you know, 6'9" and above guys that can dribble, pass, shoot, and can jump out of the room, jump out of the, you know, court, right? And it's kind of like, okay, I want him at, you know, the two spot. I want him at the one spot. So it's kind of like, where do the Ryan Conwells of the world go? Because if we have, you know, four of these guys, he's not going to be a center. Are we going to just going to play five out, right? So it's kind of like those types of archetypes are kind of dwindling just of, you know, past years and, you know, present guys coming into the league. But that doesn't have to say that there isn't a spot for Ryan Conwell, because I truly believe that, you know, he does have a great projection at the NBA level. But yeah, I think that's a really good point, because even if you look at, you know, the Norman Powells of the world, right? I mean, I kind of fit Ryan Conwell in that kind of sense. I think obviously Norman's a lot more of a shooting guard, I would say, than, you know, a combo guard. Same with like Tobias Harris. Obviously, Tobias Harris is taller than Ryan Conwell, but in those types of, you know, shooting guard archetypes, I could definitely see him fitting into that role. And even with the Pistons too, I think with Ryan Conwell, they need another reliable shooter, 3-point threat, and secondary creator. And Ryan Conwell kind of fits in that archetype. So I think with him, it kind of depends on, you know, team needs, team fits of those types of players, just because the margin is so small. With those types of players that are, you know, undersized, can shoot, can also play make, but also have that defensive edge too.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's just a very difficult needle to thread.
Yeah.
And Ryan Conwell, I think he's a good enough shooter that he can thread that needle. But again, you know, I go back to the Jacob Evans thing because it's the same specific deficit, right? It's like, oh, okay, great processing speed, really reads the game well, exceptional shooter. Is he athletic enough? Right. And if I just keep coming back to that, you know, at some point I'm going to say, and I think this is genuinely where I'm at with Ryan Conwell, is especially watching that Duke Louisville game, you know, it's like he was the only player on the floor for Louisville who like was giving me any hope that they were going to make a comeback. And, you know, obviously that fell, you know, basically by the time we were like 3 minutes into the second half, it was like, yeah, okay, this game is over. But like for Ryan, you know, it was one of those things where, something I've talked about with Cam Boozer before is look at how good this guy is on nights when his shot is not falling. And it was almost the opposite experience with Ryan Conwell in a really positively reinforcing way of even when nobody else can buy a basket, this guy is cool. Yeah, he's still in the game. He's still like, yeah. I said this to you before we started recording and I want to repeat it live on the show because it's so funny to me. Louisville shot under 30% from the floor in last night's game, and 32% from 3-point range. Ryan Conwell shot 50% from the floor and went 4 of 9 from 3-point range. Also did not go to the line a single time, which, you know, that's sort of the knock on Ryan Conwell is, you know, maybe it would be nice if he could get to the line a little more given his relative finishing woes. But again, it's just one of those things where it's like, it's a similar bet to Alex Caraban in a weird sort of way of this guy just does enough things right and shoots well enough that I'm willing to bet on enough other things figuring themselves out.
Yeah, I think we've talked a lot about, you know, he's a winning player. He's a high energy, high impact player. And he makes all the momentum carrying plays, right? Time and time again that, you know, add in his shooting, add in, you know, his playmaking and his versatility in terms of just his resiliency, you know, year after year. And, you know, I want to bet on him. It makes me, you know, want to root for him a lot more, right? Just because of, you know, kind of his story and his career wise. And I think, you know, his NBA outlook could either go two ways, honestly, point blank. So it's kind of like, which side are you going to, you know, bet on with him as we move forward?
All right, shall we get into quick hits and close this out, or anything else you want to say on Kamo?
No, I'm good. Let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to get us started for quick hits, which is we teased the fact that the two players who we covered today literally played against each other slightly later as you're listening to this, but last night, about 24 hours ago, as we're recording this, the two players we covered today played against each other. And I do want to point out one thing that sort of stood out to me more in that game than anything other than that Conwell screen that I mentioned. But just the relentless sort of, it felt like playing against Cam Boozer was like standing on a beach as a rock and just waiting to be turned into sand. Of like, you just sit there and every play he's doing something. He's coming at you. He's coming at you. He's coming at you. And eventually it just felt like, you know, once we got a few minutes into the second half of that game, that the entire Louisville team was like, I give up. I can't do this anymore. And, you know, again, he actually had a slightly lower than his season averages game, like 19 points, 10 rebounds, 4 assists. I guess technically he's at like 9.9 rebounds per game. So technically, I guess that brought his rebounding up. But again, it was like, this was by the stat sheet, a below average Cam Boozer game. And just watching it, which, you know, the one portion of the game that I stepped out for was, and this was really funny to me, but I stepped out when it was about 9 minutes left in the first half and it was 22-16 Duke. And I returned about 10 minutes later and there was about 5 minutes left in the first half and it was 22-16 Duke.
He was about right.
So that tells you what kind of a rock fight the first half of this game was. But there are only so many different ways that one can say, wow, Cam Boozer is really good at basketball. But that to me just sort of stood out of just the relentless pressure in every facet of the game that Cam Boozer puts on you. It's like, oh, you're expecting a break? Nope, not going to happen. You're expecting him to not cover a ridiculous amount of ground defensively and be the biggest dude on the court? Nope, not happening. You expect him to miss that pass? Absolutely not. He's making that pass every time. It was just, and again, it's not like I haven't seen Cam Boozer do this. I mean, I literally saw him doing it in person at Oop Summit last year. But even when his shot's not falling, even when X, even when Y, it's just hard to take your eyes off him on any possession.
Yeah. Yeah, I was watching that game, and it's like every time, you know, he touched the ball, it's like, okay, he's going to do something positive with this. And it's kind of like, how is this dude ever going to get stopped? I mean, it's like, take it easy on them, Cam Boozer, because, I mean, Louisville is hurting, and I thought Pat Kelsey was actually going to have a heart attack at one point. But he was all good. But, I mean, that's what Cam Boozer does to teams. I mean, honestly, I mean, he's a special, special talent, Nick.
Yeah. Well, for your side of things, let's talk about the actually arguably bigger game that happened immediately after this Duke-Louisville game that we've talked about. And talk about your guy, Braden Burries, because he had himself a game.
Yeah, I mean, the talk of the town, if you say, is, you know, this was going to be a huge test for AJ, right? And yes, it was. But I mean, Braden Burries was the star of the show. I mean, he blocked the game-winning shot from BYU. He had 29 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 steals, 2 blocks, was 7 of 13 from the field, and got to the line 14 times, and 13 of 14 from the line. I mean, the first couple minutes of the game, Nick, I mean, he had 7, I think, of the first 11 Arizona points. I mean, he was everywhere. He was driving coast to coast in transition, trying to get to the free throw line, making winning plays. He hit a lot of middies, obviously got to his spot and shot on the 3-point line as well. But I mean, he's a mini Jamal Murray. I mean, I love his game. I mean, what he was doing against BYU, and then obviously AJ, I thought he had a good game as well. Let me read out his stats for the listeners that might have not caught this game yet. But he had 24 points, 4 rebounds, 5 assists, 1 steal. Not the best shooting night for him, 6 of 24 from the field, 1 of 8 from the 3-point line. Arizona definitely honed in on him. I think Koa Pete didn't see him, you know, attacking the glass as much as you know, you're usually going to see from him at Arizona. I think having AJ being so heavily relied on too, I mean, he missed a lot of easy shots too, Nick, in this matchup, which is unfortunate just because this was such a marquee matchup. But yeah, all eyes were on Braden Burries. I mean, he definitely showed out. So I'm super happy for him.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think Koa just expended most of his energy trying to keep AJ off the scoreboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's again one of those things where the internet will be aflame because one of the top three players had a relatively bad game. But the part that stood out to me about AJ in that game more than anything else was, yeah, his shot's not falling. And yeah, he's getting forced into a lot of, you know, 18 footers where he's, you know, guy all up in his grill, often Koa, but, you know, someone face guarding him, right? And it's like, and he still got 24 points because he got to the line, what, like 16 times, something like that? It's like,
yeah, 11 out of 16. Yeah.
Okay. I did remember that correctly. Yeah. It's just, it's so difficult to have a game with even mediocre efficiency when you go 6 of 24 from the field. And for AJ, again, it was like, the 18 misses were, you know, I don't have the film directly in front of me, but like, I'm willing to bet almost all of them were, you know, jump shots where he was face guarded, and none of them were closer than, like, I'd be stunned if many of them were closer than 15 feet, right? It's like Arizona just forced him out on the perimeter and basically said, we're going to make you beat us. Everybody else, you know, do whatever you want, right? And the fact that he got to the line as often as he did, despite just, you know, players hanging off him every possession, that was stunning. And again, not his best night. There will definitely be people who are all up in arms about how hideously inefficient he was. And yeah, not his best night, but for him to do what he was able to do, despite all of the above, you know, it's encouraging in a weird way, but it is still kind of encouraging in a way of like, oh, if this is what a worst night looks like from AJ Devonta, that's a pretty good worst night to have.
Yeah. And heading into halftime, I mean, BYU was down by 13 as well. And they almost won off a game winner if it wasn't, you know, for Burry. So, yeah, I think with AJ too, I mean, you mentioned, I mean, Arizona wanted him to beat them, right? And he just came off of, you know, a historic performance of, you know, 43 points at the BYU single game record, scoring record too. So, I mean, him coming off that and still being able to, you know, have 24 points, get to line 16 times, I think that's a major win for him against the number one team in the country.
Yeah. Plus, you know, worth shouting out, anytime the Danny Ainge record falls is good for humanity. So, you know, AJ breaking the BYU scoring record, all credit to you, my guy. Really happy for you.
That's a good shout, Nick.
All right. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to end on a better joke than that.
So, yeah. We might just call it quits now. Yeah, perfect. Let's do it.
Shout out to you, Danny Ainge, I guess. All right. So that will, in fact, do it for us today. Thank you all so much for tuning in. If you've been enjoying the show, please be sure to leave a rating and a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. Always appreciate those 5-star ratings. If you want to check us out on YouTube as well, you can, of course, find us there as well. Like and subscribe if you haven't already. And if you've been enjoying the deep dive specific portion of the show, feel free to reach out to us either via social media, page at pageauto_, me at NBA Johnson, or feel free to shoot me an email if you have deep dive specific feedback, nickaj.mba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.